Today is June 15, 2026. This is your geopolitics briefing for Briefing Desk. In the next 30 to 33 minutes, we'll cover Ukraine's expanding deep strike campaign against Russian energy and military infrastructure, the fragile U.S.-Iran memorandum process following Bloomberg's reporting that Tehran restored roughly three-quarters of its pre-war missile arsenal during the ceasefire, and India's final clearance for the Great Nicobar Island container port, a project that Admiral D.K. Joshi says could become one of the most significant in the Indo-Pacific. Let's begin with Ukraine, where the scope of the country's strike campaign against Russian territory has grown substantially in 2026. President Volodymyr Zelensky announced in early May that missile strikes had doubled since March and quadrupled since February. Those are Ukrainian government figures, and the trajectory they describe is consistent with independent tracking. The Center for Information Resilience documented a 300% increase in Ukrainian attacks on Russian air defense and electronic warfare assets during March and April alone, nearly 80 systems targeted across 8 weeks. What has changed most visibly is the depth of penetration. Strike operations are no longer confined to border regions or recently occupied territories. Refineries in Krasnodar Krai, Ryazan, Perm, Stavropol, and near Baltic port facilities at Primorsk and Ust-Luga have all been struck. In late April, a facility in Perm, more than 1,000 miles from the Ukrainian border, was hit, which analysts flagged as particularly significant because it moved the campaign well beyond the tactical and operational zones Russia had been trying to defend. A few weeks later, in mid-May, the Solnechnogorsk oil loading station was struck, producing visible black smoke over Moscow. And in a development with direct military-industrial implications, Ukrainian FP-5 Flamingo cruise missiles struck a production facility in Cheboksary in May. That facility has been identified as a key producer of electronics and navigation guidance systems, the kinds of components that go into modern Russian missiles, located more than 900 kilometers from the front lines. Hitting it is not just symbolic, it is an attempt to disrupt the supply chain that keeps Russian precision weapons in the field. The economic consequences of this sustained energy infrastructure campaign are becoming quantifiable. The pace of oil infrastructure strikes forced Russia to cut crude production by an estimated 300,000 to 400,000 barrels per day in April alone, described in reporting as the sharpest monthly decline since the COVID pandemic. A fuel facility in Volgograd producing approximately 400,000 barrels per day was struck and is described as no longer operational, with roughly 45% of Russia's national budget derived from oil export revenues. Those aren't just industrial losses, they're fiscal ones. The downstream effects are now visible at the retail level. Moscow and St. Petersburg have imposed a 20-liter per vehicle gasoline limit. The same restriction has been introduced in the Kursk region, Buryatia, and Zabaykalsky Krai. Krasnodar and Murmansk have gone further, banning citizens from filling fuel canisters entirely. In occupied Crimea, the situation is more acute. Governor Sergei Aksionov imposed limits on a common grade of gasoline and introduced a fuel coupon system by early June. Both Aksionov and the governor of Sevastopol acknowledged the shortage would require at least 30 days to resolve. The structural problem is geographic. Fuel cannot be transported via the Crimean Bridge for safety reasons. Ferry crossings are weather-dependent, and the land corridor is the primary supply artery to the peninsula. Ukraine has been targeting that corridor deliberately, and the coupon system is the visible result. Ukraine's defense ministry formalized its interdiction strategy under a program called Logistics Lockdown, announced by Defense Minister Mykhailo Fedorov in late May. The ministry allocated approximately $113 million to drone brigades through a merit-based points system. Fedorov claimed Ukraine had quadrupled destruction of Russian logistics assets, warehouses, depots, command posts, since the start of 2026. Those are Ukrainian government claims and are not independently verified. However, the Institute for the Study of War, assessing the campaign independently, concluded that Ukraine's intermediate-range strike operations had complicated Russian logistics and prevented Moscow from moving reinforcements and supplies forward in the volumes it had previously achieved. That's a meaningful endorsement of the campaign's operational effect, even if the specific multipliers Fedorov cited cannot be confirmed.
The weapon systems driving this campaign deserve close attention, because the economics underlying them represent a structural shift in how this conflict is being fought. At the tactical level, small first-person view drones, FPV drones costing a few hundred dollars to manufacture, now account for approximately 80% of all battlefield casualties. During a single Russian assault in mid-May, Russia launched 1,567 attack drones. Ukraine intercepted 1,473 of them, a 94% interception rate. That is a remarkable operational performance, and it was achieved partly through a new category of weapon, the interceptor drone. Ukraine's Sting FPV interceptor drone costs approximately $2,100 per unit. The cheapest Russian Shahed-type drone costs a minimum of $35,000 per unit. In that single engagement, Sting interceptors accounted for more than 100 kills, with interceptor drones overall accounting for roughly 30% of all drones brought down. The cost asymmetry favors Ukraine substantially. Building on that, the Hornet drone, priced at approximately $5,000, is being directly compared to the Russian Lancet X-51, which costs approximately $68,000. Azov Corps footage, published on May 8, showed Hornets operating over Russian-occupied Donetsk and Mariupol, hunting logistics vehicles along highways approximately 100 miles behind the front line. That's not a battlefield drone. That's a deep interdiction platform operating at a price point that makes sustained campaigns economically viable. The company producing many of these systems is Firepoint, a startup founded in 2022 by engineers, architects, and game designers. They currently produce 100 FP1 drones per day at a unit cost of approximately $55,000 with a range of 1,000 miles. Their FP5 Flamingo cruise missile, the one Zelensky called Ukraine's most successful missile, carries a 2,200-pound warhead and has a stated range of 1,800 miles. That is the weapon that struck the guidance systems facility in Cheboksary. In February 2026, Firepoint conducted the first test launch of the FP7 medium-range ballistic missile with a stated range of approximately 130 miles. And in March, Firepoint's chief designer Denis Stillerman announced the FP9, a longer-range ballistic missile claimed to be capable of reaching Moscow by summer, with an impact speed stated at over 1,200 meters per second, compared to approximately 800 meters per second for Russia's Iskander. Stillerman estimated roughly a 1-in-4 strike success rate for the FP9. That is a modest figure, but on a target the size of a major military or industrial installation, it may be sufficient. The FP2 drone deserves separate mention, because it is the primary platform identified in Ukraine's logistics interdiction campaign. It carries a warhead of approximately 105 kilograms, operates at a range of roughly 200 kilometers, and requires a launch setup of approximately 18 minutes. Firepoint co-founder Stillerman has confirmed its operational use. It is, in effect, the workhorse of the logistics lockdown campaign. One supply chain detail worth noting: a 50-kilometer spool of fiber-optic cable that cost approximately $300 in 2022 now costs approximately $2,500. That eightfold increase is attributed to surging demand from both sides of the conflict. Notably, both Ukraine and Russia import most of their fiber-optic cable from the same Chinese suppliers, a detail that speaks to Beijing's quiet leverage over both parties. Ukraine has been moving toward radio-controlled systems and is described as less reliant on cable-guided drones as a result. Ukraine's drone capabilities have also attracted international commercial and security interest well beyond the conflict zone. By March 2026, more than 200 Ukrainian drone pilots had deployed to the Persian Gulf to assist U.S. and Gulf state forces in countering Iranian drone attacks. Ukraine's SkyMap anti-drone platform was operating at Prince Sultan Air Base in Saudi Arabia after Iranian Shahed drones caused more than $1 billion in damage to U.S. facilities in the region. Defense agreements were subsequently signed with Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and Qatar, which means Ukraine's defense industry is now a factor in Middle Eastern security architecture as well. Now to the Russian side of the ledger, where the military and economic indicators have crossed measurable thresholds in 2026. The most significant development may be this. The Institute for the Study of War reported that in January 2026, Russia's casualty rate surpassed its recruitment rate for the first time since the full-scale invasion began. Zelensky estimated in March that Russia lost approximately 89,000 troops while recruiting only 80,000 over the previous 3 months. Daily recruitment in the first quarter of 2026 fell to between 800 and 1,000 individuals, a 20% decrease from the 1,000 to 1,200 per day seen in 2025. This is happening despite sign-on bonuses that have reached 1.47 million rubles against an average annual wage of 1.29 million rubles. The bonus exceeds a year's average earnings, and recruitment is still declining. Approximately 40% of recruits are described as drawn from what analysts characterize as vulnerable population groups, including prisoners and debtors. Russia's unmanned systems forces, the branch most dependent on technically skilled personnel, hit only 16% of their recruiting targets for tech-savvy candidates over 4 months of active recruitment. That is a significant operational gap in an era defined by drone warfare. The human cost on the battlefield has also escalated sharply. Russian forces lost approximately 120 personnel per square kilometer of captured territory in 2025. By 2026, that figure had risen to approximately 316 killed and wounded per square kilometer. Ukrainian government figures, issued as official claims and not independently verified, placed mid-2026 casualties at more than 35,000 killed or seriously wounded per month. Russia's macroeconomic position has deteriorated in parallel. GDP growth for 2025 came in at approximately 1%. Russia's government revised its 2026 forecast down to 0.4%, and the economy contracted by 0.3% in the first quarter of 2026. Military spending reached $190 billion in 2025, 7.5% of GDP, the highest share since the Soviet Union's collapse, with the 2026 military budget expected to account for approximately 40% of total federal expenditure. To manage the fiscal strain, Russia raised its value-added tax rate from 20% to 22% at the start of 2026. Interest rates reached 21% before coming down to approximately 16%. The official unemployment rate stands at 2.2%, but that figure reflects labor shortage, not economic strength. Russia's workforce has been depleted by military service, emigration, and wartime demographic strain. One figure that is striking, even with attribution caveats, reporting from the Kyiv Post, placed Russia's military spending in the first quarter of 2026 at $74 billion, equating to approximately $813 million per day, or $34 million per hour. That figure originates from a Kyiv Post military correspondent and national security advisor, not from an independent institutional source, and should be treated accordingly. The same source described a reported $10 billion Russian government disbursement to the oil industry for refinery rebuilding, a figure that, if accurate, suggests Moscow is trying to repair the infrastructure Ukraine is actively striking. An independent analyst assessed that Russia retains sufficient resources to sustain its current campaign for approximately 1 to 2 years. But the same analyst cautioned that Putin does not operate on that timeline, and that Putin remains receptive to incremental battlefield narratives from generals who have an institutional interest in continuing the conflict. The analyst also noted that 21 packages of sanctions have been implemented, but that criminal prosecutions of sanctions violators are, in the analyst's characterization, practically non-existent. Sanctions without enforcement create leverage without consequence. A June 12th Kremlin meeting produced an instructive moment. Putin twice claimed Russia has developed a domestic satellite internet system comparable to Elon Musk's Starlink for drone control. Frontline Russian soldiers at the meeting openly contradicted that claim, stating no such system is available to them on the battlefield. The Institute for the Study of War assessed that Putin's partial acknowledgement of battlefield setbacks, including his admission that advances are moving, not as fast as they would like, is calibrated to maintain credibility with frontline troops.
The gap between the public performance and the battlefield reality appears to be narrowing to the point where it's difficult to paper over, even in a controlled Kremlin setting. Moving to the Middle East, where the U.S.-Iran conflict and subsequent negotiating process remain the defining diplomatic variable. Reporting cited in this briefing characterizes the U.S.-Iran war as having failed to achieve its principal stated objectives. The Iranian government remains in power, Iran's nuclear stockpile is intact, and its missile and drone capabilities are described as largely undiminished. That is a stark assessment, and it shapes the negotiating dynamic that follows. The nuclear dimension is the most acute concern. Iran holds approximately 400 kilograms of uranium enriched to 60%, described as close to weapons grade. That material is believed to be stored at a site identified as Pekax Mountain, assessed as too deep for advanced bunker buster munitions, and largely left intact during the U.S. bombing campaign. With limited additional refinement, this stockpile would be sufficient to produce approximately a dozen nuclear devices. The facility at Natanz was heavily bombed, but is already showing signs of restoration. The Horemshahr ballistic missile is identified as the most likely Iranian delivery vehicle for nuclear warheads, should Iran develop them. The U.S. negotiating position calls for a complete end to Iranian nuclear enrichment, transfer of the 400-kilogram stockpile, and severe restrictions on Iran's ballistic missile program. Iranian officials characterize nuclear energy as a sovereign right, describing it as non-negotiable, while expressing willingness to temporarily limit certain aspects in exchange for sanctions relief and economic normalization. That is a familiar gap between the two positions, but the context has changed because both sides have now exchanged fire. On June 8, Iran launched several waves of missiles toward military bases in central and southern Israel, the first direct exchange of fire since a ceasefire in April, in response to an Israeli strike on Beirut the preceding day amid renewed Hezbollah fighting. Israel subsequently conducted airstrikes against military targets inside Iran. President Trump intervened, and both sides agreed to step back from further escalation. The episode illustrated the fragility of the current pause. A single strike in Lebanon was sufficient to restart the Iran-Israel exchange within 24 hours. Bloomberg reported that during the 8-week ceasefire, Iran restored approximately 3/4 of its pre-war missile arsenal, and that Iran likely added newly manufactured Russian missiles to its stockpiles during that window. Western intelligence officials emphasize that Iran remains capable of launching high-intensity operations if regional hostilities resume. That assessment matters because the ceasefire was presented, at least publicly, as a period of diplomatic de-escalation. The missile reconstitution suggests Iran used that time operationally. Pakistani Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif stated that Islamabad has been actively coordinating the diplomatic roadmap between Washington and Tehran, characterizing a resolution as closer than it has ever been. President Trump stated a peace agreement could be signed as early as the weekend, with Vice President J.D. Vance and others scheduled to attend a signing ceremony in Europe. Those are the public statements. What remains unclear is whether the gap on uranium enrichment in the missile program has actually been bridged, or whether the optimism reflects pressure to produce a diplomatic result regardless of its durability. Retired British Army Colonel Philip Ingram assessed that Iran is emerging from the current episode in an emboldened position, citing Iranian leverage over the Strait of Hormuz. A section of the strait is currently closed off, and commercial vessels transiting without prior coordination with Iranian authorities are described as subject to targeting. The countries most affected by the strait's partial closure include Japan, South Korea, the Philippines, Thailand, and much of Europe. The United States is among the least affected, given domestic energy capacity and access to Venezuelan crude, but that asymmetry creates a diplomatic problem,
Washington can tolerate a partial strait closure more easily than its allies can, which means the economic pressure falls on U.S. partners rather than on the U.S. itself. If those allies cannot restore stable energy flows, their stockpiles will be depleted within months. Israel's strategic position introduces a further complication. Israeli elections are scheduled for October. Netanyahu, whose stated objectives include weakening Iran and rolling back its regional influence, faces domestic pressure to retaliate more decisively, and that pressure intensifies as the election approaches. That creates a direct tension with Trump's objective of stabilizing energy markets and securing a diplomatic exit. The Israeli and American timetables do not align, and the June 8th exchange demonstrated how quickly a regional event can overturn a ceasefire that both Washington and Tehran have an interest in maintaining. A significant data point has emerged from the China-Russia relationship, and it concerns energy rather than weapons. President Xi Jinping told President Trump, according to reporting in the Financial Times, that Putin might come to regret invading Ukraine. That is a notable statement from Beijing, given the public language of strategic partnership between China and Russia. More concretely, Putin's recent visit to China, described as accompanied by one of the strongest diplomatic delegations Putin has deployed in recent memory, failed to secure a deal for the Trans-Siberian 2 gas pipeline. That pipeline was Putin's mechanism for redirecting Russian gas exports to China following the loss of European markets. Colonel Ingram assessed that Xi's decision not to conclude the pipeline agreement represents a step back in the China-Russia relationship, even if the public optics of the visit were managed to suggest otherwise. The financial logic for China is straightforward. Beijing can import Russian gas on favorable terms without committing to the infrastructure investment that would make that dependency permanent. Leaving Putin without the deal gives China continued leverage. Building on that, the Royal United Services Institute has documented Russia's military-industrial dependency on Western and Western-aligned technology supply chains, including microelectronics used in modern missiles and machine tools used in tank manufacturing. China's selective supply posture continues to shape that vulnerability. And as noted earlier, both Ukraine and Russia import most of their fiber optic cable from the same Chinese suppliers. Beijing is, in effect, supplying inputs to both sides of the conflict, a position that gives it leverage without formal commitment to either. Now to South Asia and the Indo-Pacific, where India has granted final clearance to the Great Nicobar Island Development Project. Admiral D.K. Joshi, Lieutenant Governor of the Andaman and Nicobar Islands and former Chief of the Indian Navy, described the project as part of a broader transformation of infrastructure across an island chain he said had been neglected for 6 decades following Indian independence. His framing is worth pausing on. He is describing not just a port, but a strategic correction of a half-century of underinvestment in one of India's most geographically significant territories. The aviation infrastructure being developed consists of 4 full-length runway sites, spaced approximately 250 kilometers apart along a north-south axis covering roughly 750 kilometers. The sites are at Great Nicobar Island, Karnakobar, Sri Vijayapuram, and INS Kohasa at Shibpur, where runway extension works are underway toward approximately 3 kilometers. All 4 are designated dual-use, meaning civilian and military, facilities. Digital bandwidth has increased approximately 200-fold since 2020, from a total of approximately 3 gigabits per second to 200 gigabits per second on the Chennai to Sri Vijayapuram sector and 100 gigabits per second to outer islands via an optical fiber cable of approximately 2,600 kilometers. That is not consumer infrastructure. That is the kind of connectivity that supports sustained military operations and real-time intelligence sharing. The centerpiece of the project is the International Container Transshipment Port. Phase 1 would provide just under 6 million TEU capacity. The final phase would reach approximately 21 million TEUs, which Joshi assessed could place it among the top 2 or 3 container handling ports within India, and potentially one of the most significant in the Indo-Pacific. Total investment is cited at approximately 1 lakh crore rupees, roughly $12 billion, with the acknowledged expectation that final figures will exceed that amount. Approximately 25,000 direct and indirect jobs have been created in the preliminary phase alone. The strategic rationale is explicit in Joshi's own framing. He described the 10th parallel as a significant maritime corridor and noted that extending it eastward by approximately 300 kilometers reaches the South China Sea. He referenced Thailand's planned land bridge, ports approximately 45 kilometers apart, connected by high-speed rail, as a potential routing alternative for traffic currently transiting the Malacca Strait, which Joshi estimated carries of the order of 1 lakh ships per year, that is, roughly 100,000 vessels annually. A port at Great Nicobar positioned at the western entry of that corridor changes the geometry of Indo-Pacific maritime trade. Joshi characterized the island chain as a gateway rather than a springboard for India's Act East policy, language that is diplomatically calibrated to signal commercial intent rather than military projection, while the dual-use infrastructure speaks for itself. On the environmental side, the National Green Tribunal reviewed the project from 2024 through February of the cited year. Approximately 250 crore rupees over 30 years has been allocated for mitigation and conservation measures, with 35 crore designated for the first 5 years, directed toward the Wildlife Institute of India, the Reef Research Foundation of India, and the Zoological Survey of India. Joshi stated unequivocally that not one tribal person has been relocated or dislocated in connection with the project. The transcript does not include responses from environmental groups or tribal community representatives, so independent assessments of those claims are not available in this briefing. Pakistan enters this briefing from two directions simultaneously, as a country under significant internal strain and as a self-described diplomatic intermediary between Washington and Tehran. A Pakistani analyst interviewed by Strat News Local described the country's economic condition as going from bad to worst. IMF conditionalities are characterized as an additional burden on the population. At least two active insurgencies are underway, and multiple borders are described as hot, the eastern border particularly active after 2025, the western border problematic for several years. The budget release, originally scheduled for June 5th, was delayed to approximately June 10th, with no expectation of material relief for the population. That is a government managing multiple crises simultaneously, with limited fiscal headroom to address any of them. On Pakistan's mediation role, U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham publicly questioned Pakistan's suitability as a neutral intermediary between Washington and Tehran. The Pakistani analyst attributed that skepticism to Graham's alignment with pro-Israel positions. Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif, for his part, characterized a diplomatic resolution as closer than it has ever been, and described Islamabad as actively coordinating the diplomatic roadmap between Washington and Tehran. No specific mediation proposals or their formal governmental reception are detailed in available reporting, but the fact that both the Pakistani government and the Trump administration are publicly signaling proximity to a deal suggests at minimum a coordinated communication strategy around the diplomatic process. The analyst also described the Tehreek-e-Labbaik Pakistan Party as effectively sidelined by the military establishment, with TLP leadership having gone missing with no public accounting. The analyst traced the institutionalization of political Islam in Pakistan to General Zia-ul-Haq and described the ongoing detention of a professor identified as Javed Hafiz in solitary confinement for over 10 years, though no formal court record is provided. These details suggest a domestic political environment in which the civilian government's room for independent diplomatic maneuvering is constrained by the institutional prerogatives of the military. Relevant context for evaluating Pakistan's capacity to sustain a credible mediator role over an extended period. Finally, a cluster of diplomatic signals that may or may not converge into something substantive before the end of the year. President Zelensky sent a personal letter to President Putin calling for a face-to-face meeting to discuss ending the war. The Financial Times reported the letter was also conveyed to Putin by Roman Abramovich, former owner of Chelsea Football Club, an informal channel that suggests the formal diplomatic architecture is either insufficient or unavailable for this kind of communication. Colonel Ingram assessed the letter as containing language referencing Russia's economic difficulties and high casualty rates. He also noted that Zelensky publicly stated Ukraine would not attack the May 9th Victory Day parade, a gesture Ingram characterized as deliberate communication strategy rather than operational concession. General Budanov, described as head of Zelensky's office, stated there is a realistic opportunity to end the war before November. Ingram assessed that such an outcome depends on Putin concluding the war is lost and stated he does not currently believe Putin holds that view. A separate analyst expressed strong skepticism toward publicly signaled negotiating willingness from the Ukrainian side, characterizing it as diplomatic positioning to maintain European support rather than a substantive shift. That analyst assessed that if significant news emerges in November, it is more likely to originate from U.S. midterm election results than from the battlefield. Former German Chancellor Angela Merkel's public statement that the war could last 10 more years was referenced but not accepted at face value by the analyst who cited it. The assessment there was that Merkel's framing reflects a desire to position herself as a necessary mediator, while noting with evident skepticism that Nord Stream 2 was constructed after the 2014 annexation of Crimea. That context matters when evaluating the credibility of any European figure claiming special insight into Russian strategic decision-making. Ukraine's boxing champion Alexander Usyk held a meeting with President Trump at the White House Oval Office. The meeting was confirmed by a Trump communications advisor via a photograph shared on Platform X, but neither Usyk nor the Trump administration disclosed the agenda. Usyk subsequently stated he visited the Pentagon for the first time that day. The meeting occurred in the days before Trump's June 14th birthday, with the White House hosting preparations for a UFC event tied to the occasion. No further details about the substance of the Usyk visit are available. On the escalation watch, Ukraine's armed forces issued an assessment of a high probability that Russia is preparing to launch its Oreshnik medium-range ballistic missile within 24 to 48 hours from the Kapustin Yar test range in the Astrakhan region. The Institute for the Study of War characterized the potential launch as an attempt by the Kremlin to project military strength following the June 12th Russia Day holiday, describing long-range missile escalation as a psychological tool used to cover strategic setbacks. The pattern is familiar. When battlefield conditions are unfavorable, Moscow reaches for symbolic demonstrations of capability. The Oreshnik launch, if it occurs, should be read in that context, as a signal to domestic audiences and to NATO, not as a precursor to strategic escalation. That is the state of play as of June 15, 2026. Ukraine's strike campaign is reaching deeper into Russian territory, with domestically produced weapons at costs that sustain the effort over time. Russia's economic and recruitment indicators are deteriorating, though analysts assess the war machine can continue for 1 to 2 more years. Iran is reconstituting its missile force during the ceasefire window, while nuclear negotiations grind toward a potential agreement that may or may not close the fundamental gap on enrichment. India is building the infrastructure architecture of a major Indo-Pacific power, deliberately and without fanfare. And the diplomatic signals around Ukraine are multiplying, though the distance between public positioning and genuine strategic shift remains, for now, unmeasured. This has been your geopolitics briefing for Briefing Desk. That's your core brief for today. Thanks for listening. We'll be back tomorrow with more.